Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge.
I'm all good, as far as I know.
You know, I just came back from the Wilson House. The last few weeks have been pretty crazy for me, really very busy. And the retreat went very, very well. In fact, I ran into somebody that did some work with Tom about 30 years ago now, or 20 years ago. It was really, it's great because you start to see how the community we have, that there's a real recovery community. Mm-hmm. And it's really, it's so, it just does my heart good to see all the connections. And, you know, she was very, she still remembered your should monster.
Yeah.
And she got out of it is what she said, is that, God, you know, Tom talks so much about the should monster and the dialogues it has with us. And she mm-hmm. says, I got so much out of that. That was so helpful.
Well, it's good to know I haven't changed a bit. It's like,
it's also good to know that sometimes just there's a little something we share with somebody that just makes such a huge difference in their
life. And that in particular, and some of the stuff, and I see this in looking back at writing too, is some of the stuff that has been there from the earliest days that still is with us is because it's just spot on. And it's like, and that's definitely one of those things where I could say, if I could talk to that younger version who was leading that retreat, it's like, I'm certain I have many more insights about that should monster than he does. It's like, you know, I don't know how much he knew about it other than he was an asshole who was talking to you in your head, but it was like, we were beginning that differentiation process that you talk about.
And, you know, even when just externalize the conflict and you see it as a part of you rather than you.
For one thing, what I think the way that I learned that was, and I can use myself as an example, it's like, you know, it didn't happen this way, but I can just apply myself. When I was a drinking alcoholic and a self-hating person, there were times where I would hit walls and refrigerators and things like that. But I would also I would get so frustrated, I would just pound myself in the solar plexus till I was bruised. You know, I'd beat myself up. It's like, and eventually I had a client, a therapist that I had resolved a lot of that, but we were talking about it. She said, you know, what you had to do is get that demon out of you, because as long as you made it make sense, she said, as long as the demon was inside of you, you had no choice but to hit there, because that's where it was. And it just made me feel so much, I don't know, it just validated me. You know, like so often I say, what we do for a living is show people how they're not crazy. It's a good job we have, Alan.
Well, maybe that's the discussion for today, Patrick, is let's just talk about our relationship, Tom's intra-psychic work, and the way I describe it in Gestalt therapy is just the relationship among all these different self parts and how, you know, we can try to create an internal structure, an internal atmosphere that's going to support us in living the best life and to support our emotional sobriety.
Because the internal part is the foundation. We grow from the inside out. You know, everything does. A seed grows from the inside out. We grow from the inside out. It's like, and so often when Patrick, you were talking about emotional dependency and codependency stuff earlier, and it's like, that's what when we're trying to grow from the outside in. We're trying to get everything lined up outside, get everybody else pleased, do what I'm supposed to do, what I'm expected to do, and then I'm going to be okay. It's like, nope, it won't work that way.
How does one build that internal structure? And, you know, recently I'm working with, shouldn't say working with, I don't even know why I put it that way, but with Maddie, my ex-girlfriend. She is still homeless. She's still homeless, and the situation has progressed, and she's lost her mind. And we're trying to get her to accept help to go into some kind of residential treatment. She does not understand how it's an inside out job, and about how human resources and fellowship can bring you to things like housing, can bring you to things like gainful employment. She has become so isolated from other human beings. She's fallen on very hard times. It's very frustrating because there's some help that's available for her. She needs to outstretch her hand and take it. And she is not willing to do it. And I know well from years of working with people like you and being in treatment recovery myself that, you know, you cannot implant that into a person. That has to come from themselves. And it's very difficult to watch somebody destroy themselves. Yeah, I was telling a friend of mine from the program the other day, and he's like, you know, it sounds like you need to go to a CODA meeting or a Al-Anon meeting. And I'm like, well, clearly. But to me, it sounded like a fuck off. It sounded like, okay, here's my prescription pad. Have a nice day. You know, it's like I'm right here talking to you.
I don't know the guy, but it's good advice. I mean, a good Al-Anon, you're going to be, yeah, it's because it doesn't have to be a fuck off. It's like, it's just, I think it's hard for us to be powerless over alcohol, being powerless over other people. I mean, Alan, isn't that a lot what we get into with emotional sobriety, that it's the bigger picture that we want with the best of intentions. Most of the time we want to change things that need to be changed. But we don't have the power to change things outside of ourselves.
You know, that's where your work and my work really overlaps very nicely in terms of internal family systems describes it as how these parts are related in terms of like a family, right? That they work together like a family, or more like a dysfunctional family, we should say, until. And I think that the important thing that we focus on in this, you know, we've said it a lot of different ways, is how to keep the best of us, you know, in charge of the rest of us, instead of like putting a should monster in charge. When Tequila Boy ran the show, let's go get a drink. And you'd say, where do we go?
Right. I was just along for the ride. That's one of the things I've learned from you, watching you work with the Gestalt stuff. It's like, what's going to go in that empty chair? Any number of things. I mean, there's so many variables that you can do there. You're just not limited.
Well, you're not. And seeing oftentimes, like you said, see, like these parts, you know, they do have obviously an origin. And, you know, Sometimes like the should monster, and you've seen this a lot, all of a sudden somebody will sit there and say, God, that sounds just like my father, or my God, that's my
father.
And, you know, then we can shift the dialogue right over to the unfinished business with their mother or father and help them say some of the things and deal with some of the things that they never.
It's interesting. You may not remember this, and I don't know why I do, because the very first workshop we did accidentally together, that very dynamic came up with, you were working with a woman, and you were and I thought I was not going to have to work that day, and you invited me over to do this, and I was going, oh shit. It's like, but what we did put our two things together that day. You were talking about a relationship with a parent, and what I did is I came in and said, okay, well, we need to find the corresponding intrapersonal parent that's saying this, because you can change your relationship with your parent outside of your skin, but if you don't change the inner, it's not gonna stand. And it's like, it was because I think, if I remember correctly, the parent she was working with was still alive, so I think they were still having a relationship, and it's like, so it was perfect to basically say, we got to do both.
Let me read to you a passage from, I think you'd like, well, I'd be interested in hearing your reaction to this. So Dr. Polster was one of the, I call, first generation of Gestalt therapists trained by Fritz Perls and some of the other original Gestalt, you know. Right? And he wrote that. So this is what he says. The selves that people feel stuck with are fixed into position when continuing experiences, for whatever reason, not registered. People stay the same because they don't let new experiences teach them differently.
One of the tenets of emotional sobriety that we're talking about on a regular basis these days is, it's not just your right to learn from experience, it's your responsibility to learn from experience. because nothing's changing unless you do.
People stay the same because they don't let new experiences teach them differently. Since cells are configurations formed out of experiences, reconnecting isolated experiences helps us also in recovering fluidity of the cells within.
I can say for a fact that I have gone years without letting the world make an impression on me, or certainly not a positive impression. And sometimes the floodgates are closed. How does one break through that? I don't know. Definitely collaboration with others. Other people telling me that there's something I might be missing.
You know, as much as we're talking about this being, we're going to be in charge of ourselves, one of the things we're going to be able to do is we're really going to take the risk of trusting each other, other people, to guide us. You know, we don't give our power away to them. I don't say I'm going to do whatever Alan says or whatever Alan feels about me is what he, how, whatever he thinks about me determines how I feel about myself. But it's like, it's that little nutshell we have that says, I respect your opinion. I trust my judgment.
Trust is a big deal to move forward. Yeah. You need to be able to trust. Yeah.
It's true that being in relationship to other people can inspire us to reorganize what's going on inside of us. But see, that final change comes with that reorganization of our personality. Mm-hmm. See, that's what, when Tom is talking about the way he changed his relationship to these other parts of himself, was that he was no longer going along with the ride. Right. Now there was a part of himself that stepped back and says, is that really good for me? And do I really want to do it based on what I have learned when I've done that? See, that's where the learning from our experience becomes so important. I'll never forget, you said one time, Tom, that really struck me. He says, I don't know why we give those parts of us so much authority, because they've been talking to us for a long time and they don't seem to be helping much.
If this was somebody on the outside of you and they was giving you this advice all the time, what would you do? I'd probably stop listening to them. It's like, but because they're in here and we're so used to it. Yeah. It's like, and, but that you nailed it. What we need to do, you know, and this is where we disappoint people by saying, oh, by the way, we're not going to get rid of anything, because everybody wants to, that's our human nature, just to say, I want to get rid of this. We say, but we're going to change our relationship with it. And basically, the way we're going to do that is we're going to take back our authority. You know, it's like, because, you know, and you mentioned we were talking about codependency. The definition of that, I used it for years and years, was just simply, whatever you think of me will determine how I feel about myself. You know, and then I would add a thing. It's not that either, because truly what we were doing is whatever I think you think of me is going to determine how I feel about myself, because what you're actually thinking is not going to be that important to me as much as I'm going to look at your facial expressions and I'm going to make up stories. The little fiction guy in my head is going to make up stories and tell me why Alan is disapproving of this, or why you think I'm an idiot, Patrick. And then those are the stories I'll go away from this conversation with. It's like, and so basically, I've had all of the relationships within myself that day, rather than letting you guys in.
Well, it still tears me up when people don't do what I want them to do. And, you know, and that is not emotional sobriety.
That does suck.
I'm into that, brother. I'm into that.
It's not like, oh, we're going to be peaceful with the world and all this other stuff. It's just like, no, that's a brick wall, so I'm no longer going to hit my head on it.
I don't want somebody to go back to the street and just having to be treated like an animal. I'm trying to get somebody inside. They trust the street more than they trust the helping hand. And that is difficult.
Well, that's a very important thing. I don't know what her history is with that, but I've got a new client coming in on Friday that his sister had called me, and he's an addict that's had a hard time getting and staying sober. It's like, and she said, well, what's his attitude toward coming in? And she said, well, he's kind of reluctant because of other therapy he's had. And I've gotten more upfront about this as I get older, but I'm not trying to be mean. You don't have to have a bad therapist to have a not a very good experience. You just have to have a therapist that doesn't connect. You know, it's like, you know, first of all, if you do get a beard scratcher who just doesn't say anything and just nods their head and stuff like that. I mean, if you got problems like the three of us do, that's not going to be really helpful. We need somebody to engage with us, you know. So I realized with talking to this guy's sister Friday, my job, you know, I always say my job is to surprise people. My job is to be, I do it pretty naturally. I'm not going to, you come see me, it's not going to be what you think coming to a therapist is about. My office doesn't look like a therapist's office. I cuss way more than a therapist should cuss. And so sometimes it's good to just kind of blow everything up and realize and give people permission to basically say, well, if you haven't had good experiences in therapy, no wonder you don't trust it. If I don't trust something, why don't I trust it? Well, maybe I need to give it some more effort. But it's like there's probably a story in there that explains it.
Well, and look, you know, I don't know Maddie professionally, but, you know, I know of your relationship with Maddie. And see, Patrick, I think one of the things that makes it hard for Maddie is that people that have cared about her, she hasn't been able to trust. And so when people try to help her because they care about her, she's not able to trust it. So she puts herself in a real dilemma, is that if you're expressing that you care for me, I don't really believe that you're going to operate in my best interest.
It's almost backwards, right? It's sort of like if I have a really low self-esteem, you know, what I tell you as the therapist is don't say a lot of positive things about me too early, because you will lose all credibility. Because if you think good highly of me, then you're an idiot. You know, and I never thought about that. But what you're saying about trust is, so basically, if we're just talking about learning theories, that's connected to somebody potentially being trustworthy. It's like, that's the beginning.
You know, a key to that for you, Patrick, is to start out with, I know you don't trust anyone. And I know you don't trust a place to go and really help you, because anybody that said they cared about you has really screwed you over. See, that's what she feels. And that's why she's so isolated, man. And so, you know, not willing to open up and let somebody in to really help her, because she doesn't believe that they really care. Because the people that have cared about her, she feels, whether it's right or wrong, I'm not saying she's right, right? But I think this is what she's experienced in the story she's made up about it all. Like Tom said, it's a narrative that people, and her narrative really, 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 you know, results in her withdrawing into her protective eye.
There's a reason for those kind of defenses. Those are high defenses. Yeah. Somebody like that has been hurt a lot.
And look, I can see even now, but you look so sad, man. I mean,
I know.
It's terribly sad, man. It's, you cared about her, and somebody you cared about, you see, is just not, you're helpless. You feel helpless to do anything for her. And that's terrible when somebody's really suffering and sick and you want to help and there's nothing you can do right now.
I mean, I believe I have something here that can help. Yes. If she could open up to it, but it's like, I can't take this and put it in her arms and wrap her arms around it. I have to just hand it to her, and she has to take it.
Like Tom said earlier, is that, see, if there was any way that she could start differentiating the past from the present and say the past doesn't have to determine what my, but she is so caught in that. Theme and that narrative that she's living in, it's not a possibility for her right now.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, the thing you could try, and once again, I don't know if it'll make a difference, is just to say that to her. It's just talk to her about, look, I understand how you're not letting anybody help you. You know, you felt that I betrayed you. Anybody that cared about you, you feel has fucked you over, hasn't really been there for you. I mean, look, I know she gets caught in being a victim of all this, and she's got a big hand in it all. There's no question.
Well, what's the next part? once I sit with her in her fear and her mistrust, what do you then say to that person about how to move forward?
Well, first, let me jump in here. First of all, that's no small matter. That's huge. Joining with the person is, I mean, a lot of times, and I think the mistake that I certainly have made through the years and other therapists make is they move too fast to whatever is next. It's like I wrote about this in Embracing Fear. It's like, rather than saying, if I want to give you some reassurance, rather than saying, hey, buddy, it's going to be okay. You know, it's much more reassuring than most people just to say, wow, after you describe it, that really does suck. You know, and then into that conversation, you don't have it in your conscious mind, but you walk away feeling heard. You know, you walk away feeling connected. It's like, you know, we're going to talk again, but it's like, you know, I don't have to, you know, because I don't know if you ever did that, Alan, but I always would think, everybody's got to get their money's worth. I got to get them to a solution today. I would always get in my own way. I trip over my feet, man.
But what Tom is saying is there's a lot of wisdom in it, Patrick. See, if you can create the right space, it might be possible for the forces inside of her to start to repair her rather than for you to repair her. See, that's sometimes what happens, because there is a force in us that moves us towards completion, towards resolution. But sometimes, you know, we can't create that atmosphere. See, this is where other people are important in that, is if you just recognize her struggle, that makes be that little ray of light that she can get a hold of. Now, I don't, but like Tom said, you know, staying with that is sometimes difficult, because that means being helpless for a while, just being in that pain with her, being in that dark place. She lives in a very dark place, man.
But when you can feel this is theory. I'm like you, Alan. I'm not saying this would work in practice here, but it's like, you know, you know it's pace lead that can hypnosis, right? It's like when you're pacing the person, basically, you know, reflecting back what their condition is now. That hopefully puts them in a place where they can begin to want to reach out, because as long as people are trying to sell her on recovery, on stuff like that, if you got defenses, those heels are digging in. I mean, you know, I know that because Alan, you said something about this on Thursday night not long ago. Like, doesn't matter. Just a reflex. It's like when somebody starts telling us what to do, even with the best of intentions, it's like, ooh, wait, hold on. It's like we have to override that. And right now she's not going to be able to override it. But if she could, you know, ask for something, it would be amazing.
Well, yeah. Well, you know what? The way she reached out to me is that she said that she lost another one of her cats, jumped out the window of her van that she's been living out of, and that she was going to kill herself and that she'd relapsed. And so that this dialogue has begun the last couple of days of what are we going to do? How are we going to help you? Trying to get central office to send some women to take her to a meeting. Mm-hmm. My dad ended up taking her to the house in the desert. And she's there right now, but she did reach out. She cried out for help. And I think that's where my emotional sobriety falters. And I'm kind of driven a little mad is because, you know, the joystick has been handed to me and I can't do anything with it. I'm not able to move the, now that I've got it, I can't really move it in any direction.
You don't know. Here, this is one of the first things, the first job I ever had is as a therapist working with addiction. My supervisor, now friend, for a long time friend, Claudine Jefferson, she said to me just out of the blue, I had no idea what we were even talking about. She said, do not, and she just said it with a, like this, do not ever think that you know where your help is going. She said, because you're not going to know. She says, you know, you may think you're not helping that person, but that person may bump into somebody else or bumped into somebody else that does it. You can also look at people, and we've all seen those people that we think these guys are sore and they're doing great. And then we get the call that they've killed themselves. You know, it's like, my God, it's, you know, we don't know. Our job, this is the here and now. Our job is to do, Sheldon Cobb used to say this, impeccable work. You know, he would say, you just do impeccable work. That's what we do. And it's like, that's all right now. And then and you keep doing it. And only hindsight will tell you what we've accomplished. You know, 30 years or 20 years later, you know, Alan says, you know, I did pretty well on that week long program. You know, like, oh, good. That was, you know, a success. Obviously, didn't fix her. She's still coming to Alan. It's like, you know.
Look, at you, you're saying you were helpless, but obviously you did mobilize some for her. She's now in a house rather than in her car. But you see, this is where these things don't change by changing the outside. See, that's why you can take a homeless person and provide housing for them. But oftentimes they end up back on the street. Even though they're staying, they've got housing for them, they go back to the street. I remember when my brother came out of prison, he said something to me that was so powerful and really, really, really gave me insight into this. He said, you know, Al, bro, he said, I felt more comfortable in prison than I do out here in society. I knew who I was. I knew what to expect. I don't know how to navigate this other world. Right? That he identified. See, when you identify like I'm hopeless or I'm homeless or I will always be, it's the definition ends up being a self-fulfilling prophecy. And see, that's what she's up against. She doesn't feel that there's really, she's waiting for someone to rescue her. She thought you'd be it. I remember that in the relationship. She's waiting for her family to wake up and rescue her. Why does she, won't even ask anymore for what she needs. You see that in her. I mean, yeah, she reached out to you. That's great. I do think it's great. That means that there was some real sense of care, of love that existed between you guys. But what's it like for you seeing her like this? Talk about that for a minute.
Feels like I'm being held hostage with the threat of her ending her life. And
nobody move, or I pull the trigger.
Yeah, no. And I hate it, and I feel shame. That, you know, I was telling a friend the other day that I was in a relationship more than 10 years ago where I was very on drugs and alcohol, and I got into a lot of trouble. Yeah, me. I know. Yeah. And anyway, like eventually she had to stop talking to me. You know, like I was talking to her long after I'd broken up and leaving messy voicemails and just getting into trouble. And, you know, I'm empathizing with how she must have felt back then, because I feel like just a sense of shame of like I don't recognize this person that I was with for many years, and how did things go so wrong, and what did I, like, I must have had something to do with it, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, and she's just not, she's so wounded that she just does not have the capacity to empathize with another human being. She's got to that point where she just has lost her empathy. And she has a friend, another girl, her childhood best friend, who's trying to call her, and she's blocked her number, and she's, you know, placed her into the, you know, persona non grata category. And it's it's hurtful, because I just feel like I don't sense the give. I don't sense the give. That's the hopelessness, is that I don't know if there's anything to be done at this point. I don't know.
Well, you're doing what you can, and it's just I mean, you described, by the way, what you just described was my divorce. You know, basically, I became dead weight and asshole, so that the person who was willing to work on the relationship, which Karen was and wanted to work on the relationship, had to basically take it out back and shoot it, because I was just being this pitiful lump, you know, and I grew up trained by the best of the victims, and it's like in that hostage situation where I'm holding the gun metaphorically, not in that case, not literally, to my head, not somebody else, and say, don't make a wrong move or I'll pull the trigger. It's like you know, and then all of a sudden, what happens? You created the illusion, and I always want people to know, you just created the illusion that your life is in somebody else's hands, and it's not. You know, it's like we could do a whole workshop on that, but it's like about the ethics of that. But it's like, be sure you keep working on yourself with this stuff. I appreciate Alan bringing it back to you and talking about it, because how did we all get into this job in the first place? Because we're fix it people, you know, and it's like we turned out to be really good at it. So it's like. So when I speak for myself, I go like, when I hear what you're saying, my little problem solver just goes to work upstairs, you know, probably running through all the things you've already tried. But it's like, I'm just going, okay, you know, cause you know, I don't know the woman, never met her. You sent some pictures of you guys when you were together. And so, you know, that qualifies for, I'm on her side. I want her to be okay.
And look, you are not being held hostage.
Right. That's an illusion, too. Yeah.
You're holding yourself hostage.
Amen. Good one.
You're holding yourself hostage. See, that's how we disempower ourselves, by looking at what she's doing and how she's behaving. But see, it's the hook into you, because you do care about her, that holds you hostage. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't. I'm not at all saying that. I know that strong feelings there. Sometimes it's very hard to, what Tom is saying is to just feel our powerlessness in these situations. And the fact that even with the best of intentions, you know, you remember Chris Stretch, you know, I love
him. I do, yeah.
What a great
guy. I was thinking of him just a minute ago when I was talking, yeah.
You know, my God, man, I didn't want him to take his life. I mean, But at the end of it, I'm powerless in terms of what he chose to do. Right. And, you know, and I get to the point where, I don't judge that anymore. I don't shouldn't do that. He did the best he could, man. And that was the moment that he just said, I'm done. I just don't want to do it anymore. And who am I to say that's not right? I know that there's a lot more to it, that there's other possibilities, but I can know that. And he knew it. You guys know that. He was a great therapist. He helped other people. All kinds of possibilities. Wonderfully, the way he thought about emotional sobriety, man. He taught me things when we were...
Yeah, he was a good teacher. He put things in a way that was really clear.
Very clear, man. And, I feel a lot of sadness about that still.
Well, there's a point here to make about emotional sobriety, I think, that maybe we need to do before we leave it. So all this stuff that you're describing, feeling, Patrick, of just the helplessness and powerlessness and all this and pain, and you're seeing somebody you love and it hurts you and all this other stuff, you know, emotional sobriety is not changing things so much inside you, you don't have any of that experience. You know, our experience, we're going to experience ourselves fully. And so the idea is, what it means is there is that decision maker that basically is going to take all that stuff, respect all of that stuff, and help you make decisions. And if I'm in your place, I would need to make decisions with a little bit of a committee here. I would be here with you guys talking about it, because I need some backups, some reassurance. But basically, I'm not going to tell myself I'm doing anything wrong by feeling it. I'm just saying, like, no, it sucks. It's hard, you know, and And like a sponsor of mine used to say, well, or would you rather be her? And I go, nope. If we're really honest, any one of us can be in that spot sometime in the future.
I am grateful for the life I have and what I've been able to build little by little. I'm not grateful for my slow internet, though.
Let's end with a serenity prayer today.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.